All right, buckle up, everybody, because we are diving deep today.
Yeah.
Deep into Deuteronomy, that is, chapters 13 through 15. We're going to be looking at how the Israelites were supposed to build, you know, a unified nation after they finally reached the promised land.
Yeah.
Using this really fascinating lecture by Dr. Cynthia Parker. And just a heads up, some of these laws and customs, well, they might surprise you.
They might.
We're going to be focusing on themes of, you know, national identity and belonging, and also all of the ethical responsibilities that came with being God's chosen people.
It's interesting, isn't it? We're kind of going beyond just that, you know, grand narrative of the Exodus and really getting down to the nitty-gritty of daily life.
Right.
Like, what did it actually look like to live out this covenant with God?
Okay, so let's jump right into Deuteronomy 13.
Okay.
Which deals with this very real threat of false prophets and idolatry.
Right.
And this chapter, it doesn't hold back, you know, when it's describing some pretty harsh consequences for anyone who strays from the path.
Yeah, it's unsettling to read, definitely. But Dr. Parker, she points out that the chapter focuses on three main categories of people who pose a threat to this, like, fledgling nation.
Okay.
So first, you've got these false prophets, right, spreading misleading prophecies and potentially, like, leading people astray.
Uh-huh.
Then there's those close friends or family members who might try and entice others to follow different gods.
Oh, wow.
So that's like a threat from within,
right,
you know, the very fabric of their society.
Yeah.
And then lastly, there's this threat of, like, entire cities turning away from worshiping the one God.
Oh, wow.
Which creates a challenge on a much larger scale, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
And the language that they use to describe how they should be dealt with is strong.
Yeah.
Like eradicating or purging. It paints a pretty stark picture.
It does.
Of just how seriously they took maintaining unity and spiritual purity.
Yeah, absolutely. And it raises the question of whether these laws were meant to be, you know, literally enforced, or if they served more as a way to set an uncompromising standard, like a kind of theological boundary line.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Parker, she seems to lean towards that latter interpretation, suggesting that it's more about setting the bar incredibly high for faithfulness rather than promoting, like, widespread systematic punishment, you know?
It makes you wonder what it must have felt like to live with that kind of expectation.
Right.
You know, that unwavering commitment to one God. It almost feels like they're saying, look, we just escaped centuries of slavery in Egypt.
Yeah.
We've seen what happens when we stray from God.
Uh-huh.
We're not going back there.
Yeah. That's a powerful insight. It's like they're drawing a line in the sand.
Right.
Fiercely determined to avoid anything that might lead them back into, you know, spiritual or physical bondage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And remember, the Israelites saw themselves as sons of God, chosen and set apart. So in that context, turning away could be seen as the ultimate betrayal.
Right.
A capital offense.
Wow. So while it might be easy to just get, like, caught up in the severity of the punishments described, it's important to remember that historical context.
Absolutely.
This isn't necessarily, like, a blueprint for governance or something.
Right.
But rather a really powerful expression of their commitment.
Yes.
To their newfound freedom and their relationship with God.
Exactly. It's about establishing, like, this core identity for this new nation.
Right.
One that's rooted in their unique covenant with God.
Yeah.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit to Deuteronomy 14.
Okay.
Where the focus turns to something a little more, well, appetizing. Food.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's fascinating how what the Israelites ate was about so much more than just, you know, like a diet.
Right, right. The chapter starts by reminding them, you know, that they are sons of the Lord and a holy people. And then it jumps into all these specific guidelines about, like, you know, which animals are considered clean and unclean.
Yes.
Fit for consumption or not.
Yes.
And Dr. Parker highlights that these food laws, they weren't just about, like, hygiene or something.
Right.
But about consciously choosing what to eat as a way to solidify their unique identity.
It's a way to, like, distinguish themselves from all those surrounding nations.
Not
to
at
embody
all.
Their chosenness, but in a very tangible way. Like, it's like saying we're different and our food choices reflect that.
Yeah, yeah. And there's that interesting detail about what to do with meat from an animal that died naturally.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't eat it yourself.
Right.
But you could give it to the worger,
right,
which Dr. Parker explains was like a term for a resident alien.
Yeah.
Likely someone who was, you know, poor and vulnerable.
Yeah.
Or you could sell it to a nokri.
Right.
A foreigner just passing through.
what's fascinating here is that, like, it wasn't about the meat itself being, you know, like, inherently bad or dangerous or anything.
Right.
It's about who was considered part of the community and who wasn't.
Right, right.
So there's this built-in system of care for the Gurkha, you know, ensuring that even those on the margins of society had access to food.
Yeah, it almost feels like a safety net, you know, woven into their everyday practices.
It is.
It wasn't just about, you know, abstract ideas of holiness. Uh-huh. It had real social implications.
Yeah.
And then the chapter ends with this beautiful image of God feasting with his people.
Yes.
Showing his desire for, like, joyful celebration and a close relationship with them.
Yes.
It's almost like these food laws are a way to prepare for that ultimate feast.
I love that.
A way to live in anticipation of God's presence.
Yes. It transforms these, like, seemingly mundane regulations into something much more profound.
Right.
It's about aligning their lives, even their meals, with their understanding of who God is and what it means to be in relationship with him.
So we've seen how Deuteronomy 13 and 14 delve into these really interesting and sometimes challenging ideas about, you know, identity, belonging, and how the Israelites were supposed to live out their faith in these very tangible ways.
And just wait until we get to Deuteronomy 15.
Oh, okay.
That's where we see the rubber really meet the road, so to speak.
Okay.
With some incredibly practical applications of generosity and care for the poor.
I can't wait to unpack that. But for now, we'll pause here and let our listeners, you know, digest all we've covered so far. Welcome back, everybody. We are still deep in our exploration of Deuteronomy chapters 13 through 15.
Yes.
Uncovering how the Israelites sought to build this unified nation, you know, rooted in their covenant with God. We've talked about that serious business of false prophets and the fascinating connection between food and identity.
Right.
And now we are ready to dive into Deuteronomy 15, where the focus shifts to putting generosity and care for the poor into action.
This chapter, it really gets to the heart of what it means to actually live out your faith in a tangible way.
Okay.
You know, it's not just about avoiding sin or following rituals or anything.
Right.
It's about embodying God's character.
Yeah.
Through these acts of compassion and justice.
I'm ready to hear more about that.
Yeah.
Dr. Parker mentioned something in her lecture about the law of debt remission every 7 years.
Ah, yes.
What was that all about?
So that's one of the most striking examples of how the Israelites were really trying to build a society that reflected God's heart for the marginalized. So every 7 years, all debts between fellow Israelites.
Wow.
They were just canceled.
Really?
Yeah. And this wasn't just about offering, like, you know, temporary reprieve or something.
Right.
It was about preventing systems of injustice from taking root.
That's incredible. It's like they were proactively trying to break cycles of poverty.
Yes.
And ensure that everyone had a chance to kind of get back on their feet.
Exactly.
But wouldn't that be really hard for the lenders, though? I mean,
to just let go of all those debts.
It definitely required a deep trust in God's provision.
Right.
And a willingness to put the well-being of the community above individual gain. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But remember, the underlying principle here was that God had blessed the Israelites so that they, in turn, could be a blessing to others.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful concept.
It is.
This idea that abundance isn't meant to be hoarded, but shared.
Yeah, it really challenges our modern ideas of, like, economics and success.
It does, doesn't it?
It's almost like they were trying to create the system where everyone had, like, a baseline level of security and dignity.
Yes.
Regardless of their, you know, financial circumstances.
And it wasn't just about releasing debts.
Yeah.
You know, Deuteronomy 15, it also addresses the treatment of servants.
Okay.
Requiring them to be set free after 6 years of service.
Wow.
And provided with generous provisions to help them start their new lives.
So it's about recognizing the inherent worth and dignity of every person.
Regardless of their, you know, social standing or economic status.
Yes.
It's about creating a society where everyone has the opportunity to flourish.
Exactly.
But as inspiring as these principles are, I can't help but wonder how effectively they were put into practice.
You know, right.
Human nature being what it is.
Yeah.
I imagine there were plenty of challenges and inconsistencies.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to raise that question. You know, there's always a gap between ideals and reality.
Right.
We can't, like, romanticize the past or assume that these principles were always perfectly upheld or anything.
Right.
But I think what's important is the intention behind these laws.
Okay.
They offer a glimpse into a worldview where compassion, generosity, and justice are woven into the very fabric of society.
And speaking of weaving things into the fabric of society,
yeah.
Dr. Parker highlighted something really interesting
okay.
about the specific body parts mentioned in Deuteronomy 15.
Oh, right.
When it comes to interacting with the poor.
Yeah.
She talked about the hand, the heart.
Yes.
And the eye.
Mm-hmm.
What was the significance of that?
That's one of those details that, you know, it might seem insignificant at first glance.
Right.
But when you dig deeper,
yeah.
it reveals this profound insight into the nature of true righteousness.
Okay.
So the hand, it represents action.
Yeah.
You know, the concrete steps we take to help those in need.
Okay.
The heart, it symbolizes our inner attitude.
Yeah.
You know, the compassion and empathy we cultivate within ourselves.
Right.
And the eye represents how we see and judge those who are less fortunate.
So it's not just about, like, throwing money at a problem or doing the bare minimum out of a sense of obligation.
Right, exactly.
It's about approaching others with a genuine desire to understand their needs.
Yeah.
And to offer support in a way that affirms their dignity.
Exactly. It's about embodying those virtues
yeah.
in every interaction, seeing the image of God in every person we encounter, regardless of their circumstances.
It reminds me of that famous quote from Micah 6.8. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God.
Yeah.
It's not about, like, elaborate rituals or, you know, complex theological doctrines.
Right.
It's about living out your faith in a way that impacts the lives of those around you.
And that brings us to one of the most powerful messages in Deuteronomy 15.
Okay.
And perhaps in the entire book of Deuteronomy.
Okay.
The idea that the Israelites' motivation for ethical behavior stem from their experience of God's own loving kindness and grace.
It's not about earning God's favor or following a set of rules out of fear.
No.
It's about responding to the love and mercy they'd already received.
It's like this ripple effect, you know.
Yeah.
You experience God's goodness.
Right.
And that compels you to extend that same goodness to others, especially those who are, you know, most vulnerable and in need.
It's a beautiful and profound concept.
It really is. And it makes you wonder,
yeah.
you know, if we were to apply that same principle to our own lives, our own communities,
mm.
how might things change? What would it look like to build a society where compassion and generosity are the driving forces behind, you know, our choices, our policies, our interactions with one another?
That's a question worth pondering, isn't it? We've seen how the Israelites attempted to create a society where care for the poor and vulnerable
yes.
was woven into the very fabric of their, you know, laws and customs.
Yes.
Well, we can acknowledge that they didn't always succeed. You know, their efforts offer us a powerful model
yes.
for how we might approach similar challenges in our own time.
Absolutely.
Perhaps by studying their successes and failures, we can glean some wisdom about how to build a more just and compassionate world.
Yes.
A world where everyone has the opportunity to experience the fullness of life
yeah.
that God intends. It's amazing how these chapters in Deuteronomy, you know, they were written thousands of years ago.
Right.
But they still resonate with us today. It's like we're looking through this window into the past
uh-huh.
and seeing how the Israelites, you know, they grappled with
yeah.
some of the same fundamental questions that we still wrestle with today.
It speaks to the enduring power of these texts, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. They offer us a framework for thinking about, like, identity and community.
Uh-huh.
And what it actually means to live ethically in a world that doesn't right. always make it easy.
We've seen how they intertwine these ideas of identity, belonging,
yeah.
and ethical responsibility. They understood that. Like,
yeah.
you know, a strong community requires shared values,
mm-hmm.
a commitment to justice,
yeah.
and a willingness
yeah.
to care for the most vulnerable.
And they didn't shy away from the, you know, the messy realities of human nature either.
Right. right.
They acknowledged that even with the best intentions, like,
yeah.
we're going to fall short. We're going to make mistakes.
But they also offered, like, a path forward.
They did.
A way to continually reorient ourselves towards justice,
uh-huh.
generosity, and love.
And remember how these values, they weren't just, like, abstract ideals. You know, they were woven into the fabric of their daily lives.
Yeah.
What they ate,
uh-huh.
how they treated their neighbors.
Right.
How they structured their society. It was all connected.
That's such a crucial point. You know, it's not enough to just talk about these things.
Right.
We have to actually live them out in concrete ways.
Yes.
You know, our actions, our choices, our systems,
mm-hmm.
they all reflect our values.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most valuable lessons we can take away from Deuteronomy.
Okay.
It's a call to live intentionally.
Yeah.
To be mindful of the impact we have on the world.
Right.
And to strive to create a society that reflects God's heart for justice and mercy.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Deuteronomy 13 to 15, I'm curious.
Yeah.
What stood out to you about the Israelites' approach to building their nation?
Well, for me, it's the recognition that true righteousness isn't just about avoiding, you know, bad things.
Right.
It's about actively doing good, reflecting God's character in the world. And that doing good, that extending kindness and generosity, especially to those in need, should stem from a place of gratitude.
Okay.
From having experienced, like, God's love and mercy ourselves.
It's a powerful reminder that, you know, we don't have to earn God's favor.
Right.
It's already been freely given.
Yeah.
And that knowledge should motivate us to extend that same grace to others.
We've seen how, you know, food laws, even economic practices, they were woven into the fabric of Israelite identity, right?
Yeah.
And this raises a really interesting question for us.
I'm listening.
How do our own cultural practices shape our understanding of who we are and how we should behave?
Yeah.
What values are embedded in, like, you know, the way we live our lives?
Right.
And how do those values contribute to, or perhaps detract from, the well-being of our communities?
That's a really thought-provoking question.
It is.
It challenges us to examine, you know, our own lives, our own communities, and to ask ourselves if we're truly living out the values that we claim to hold.
And perhaps by, you know, engaging in that kind of self-reflection.
Right.
By learning from the, like, successes and failures of those who came before us.
Yeah.
We can find ways to build, you know, a more just and compassionate world.
Right.
A world where everyone has the opportunity to flourish.
Thank you for taking us on this deep dive. It's been enlightening, to say the least. And to you, our listener, we encourage you to keep exploring these ideas. What resonates with you from these chapters? How do these ancient laws and principles speak to your own life and experiences? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, keep diving deep.